This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 289 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free.
While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits.
Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level.
The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just four taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as the 100 most popular.
With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest.
Robinhood is giving listeners of the Outlander podcast a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at outlander.robinhood.com.
And now on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along with chapters...
You refuse to do the other one, which actually sounds better.
Nope, I prefer it. I prefer what I'm doing. It's what I do now.
Okay,
starting with chapter 7, entitled Shrapnel. It's appropriately titled. I mean, most of her titles feed into what happens in the actual chapter, but this one is real specific.
Okay, first, let's have a check-in. In case you've forgotten, it's the same day.
Oh, my God. Stop
it's
it.
It's the last day of the gathering.
Are you sure? Are you sure? Because I don't even think Diana's sure.
It is. Claire has finished with the tooth dude and now has a sore hand from all the strength and everything it took to get the tooth actually out of his mouth. And Mr. Goodwin, the tooth dude, had paid in cash. So she's got a little jangle in the pocket there.
It was a gratifying chink.
And then Archie Hayes steps up. He's coming for a visit. He says, well, since you basically are magic and can raise the dead, I figured you could take care of this, quote, bit of stray metal, unquote.
Right.
So apparently a slave the day before or earlier that day, was examining a slave and he had had an epileptic seizure and he'd recovered just as she'd begun to examine him. And the other slave saw this as basically her laying out of hands or just starting to examine him. And the timing, him coming to, if you will, his seizure ending, that she had healed him. And they refused to accept any other explanation. So, okay, go Claire. That's great, but it's also dangerous.
Everything she does in the past is dangerous because she's in the past. with a 1940s or 60s mentality and level of skill. So
all of that, correct.
She is constantly in a state of
danger.
Yes, thank you. I was like, unsafety? That's not a thing.
So that metal that he's talking about, it was within him. Quote, over the milky skin of his left breast was the huge patch of bluish black that covered him from ribs to clavicle.
I tell you unquote. What wasn't on his chest.
The nip!
His other nipple.
His other nip was totes, or where the nip would have been, was totes white. So someone
Or totes gone. Let's just call it totes gone. Because if it's white.
It was gone.
You don't get shot and like lose the pigment in your nipple. Like literally the nipple is gone.
No, it was blown off, but the...
What was left?
The material. No, well, the scar tissue.
Puckering.
The scar tissue behind is white. It doesn't, I guess, I'm guessing doesn't have...
I mean, that's what scars do. Scars do not have any pigment.
Do not tan.
They don't. Correct. They have no melatonin.
So someone behind her said in Gaelic, by God, he's turning black. I was like, oh, Lord.
Wrong.
Very
wrong.
That's
not what's happening.
No, it was gunpowder. Only half of the ball.
Stop for two seconds. I've heard, and everyone knows famous people who've had vitiligo, right? That's what it's called?
I think so.
When their skin loses pigment. I don't know of any cases of people gaining pigment. Obviously, it has to happen. There's got to be some sort of happening of that happening. You just don't hear about it. But you hear about people who lose pigment in their skin, but you don't regularly or often hear about people who gain pigment, which is why that was so striking to me when I heard that in this chapter.
See, I don't know that people can gain a darker pigment outside of tanning. I mean, there might be drugs you could take, but I don't know that it happens naturally. It very well could. Who knows? I am not a doctor or a person who has all the knowledge of literally anything. So, but it was gunpowder, the spreading darkness, or the darkness under his skin. Only half of a ball, the cartridge, had been removed surgically when he had been treated. The other half had traveled around his body and is now literally making its way out of his back. It was just under his skin. So Claire was quite easy to take it out. We find out that half ball bullet had been with him since Culloden. Talk about a symbolic removal.
Yeah, not only symbolic removal, but also her Claire looking at him and being like, you could not have been more than
I know.
12. Two. And he's like 12. I was 11. And you're just like, oh my God, my daughter is 10. I can't imagine. Ugh, there's so many things that are happening right now all over the place. But there was a news report I read on people.com about a 10-year-old girl who was beaten to death by her 15-year-old friend in a field. She was and she reminded me so much of because she looked so much older than 10, and she was sexually assaulted and then beaten to death by her 15-year-old friend. And I'm just like, I can't. It's so many things that are so prevalent and real that become more real when you have
a little person outside of you.
A little person outside of you who is your responsibility, who you, it's like all you want to do is make sure they make.
No pressure at all.
No, exactly. And then you think her parents must have thought, she's safe. She's with her friend. They're just hanging out. And I was telling mom and dad, I was like, doesn't get to have any friends. She never gets to leave your presence. She's not with you. She's with me. That's it. We're not doing
poor
this.
Poor Tanti, come on.
I don't know. You might take her into the field and beat her to death.
What?
I'm joking.
Don't be. That's really just.
You wouldn't.
But
sorry.
This has been an interesting. And we don't need to get into the topic because it's totally off topic. But it's related to kids and bad things happening to kids, which is always our favorite thing to talk about. But I'm just going to mention it. There's not going to be any detail. But Summer and I just finished independently watching Finding Neverland. And holy hell. So, yeah, I've had kids and awful things being done to kids on my mind and heart a little bit the last few days as well.
I see my family in a lot of the stories that I read, and it makes it harder to read. And I think that I know that I've mentioned in the past how my experience reading these books changes as I change. And this was definitely one of those chapters for me.
So Archie had been 11. His birthday was the next day. This is back on at Culloden, April 16th, 1746. Claire, who thought she lost her capacity to be shocked by these types of things, discovered she was wrong. Quote, someone had shot him, an 11-year-old boy, at point-blank range. He agrees that it was a miracle he'd survived. Quote, it was that. I was lying on the ground and Murchison's face over me. Unquote. And this makes Claire do another double take. She remembers Jamie's warning about being careful around Hayes. He confirms, Hayes does, that a Murchison who'd been sent to North Carolina had been killed in a fire in the Cross Creek garrison. Hayes continues his line of questioning regarding men and the garrison fire. And just at this time, Jamie shows up, confirms that Murchison was dead. Archie calls Jamie Seamus Rui, Red Jamie.
But wasn't it met with just a little bit of drama, which is But don't you remember? Murchison had a twin who looked just like him and was twice as evil, and they're all going to come back and find you. Like, it was met with, oh, Murchison's dead. However, don't you recall?
Yeah.
There's a second one.
Yeah, it was dramatic. Mm-hmm. No one had called him Red Jamie since the Rising. So Jamie says, okay, let's do this. Hayes pulls out a paper with a red wax seal, and Claire recognized it. It was from Governor Tryon. He gives it to Jamie. Jamie does not open it. He asks Archie why he's there. Jamie confirms with him, so you're sure it was Murchison who shot you that day? Archie replies, you can't that surely. Do you not recall the day? Of course Jamie doesn't recall the day, darn it. But Archie doesn't know this. He continues as Jamie reads the missive from Tryon. Jamie indeed had saved his life. Now that startled Jamie. Jamie had struck Murchison across the head just as he was about to bayonet young Archie on the ground. Then Jamie carried Archie away from the field, quote, awa to a bitty well nearby, unquote. And if you guys have ever been to Culloden and taken that tour around the grounds, Well of the Dead.
Well of the Dead. I was like, is it Well of Souls? No, Well of the Dead.
That's funny because Well of Souls, it's the title of, there is a book and it's really good. And it's like, not just, oh, it's like, not crazy, but it's definitely deep sci-fi, like in space, on a planet, aliens. It's like, oh, it's crazy. It's good. It's really good by Jack Chalker. It's called, the first book of a series of like 6 or 7 books is called Midnight at the Well of Souls. And that's what that reminded me of. Whenever I see Well of the Dead, I think Well of Souls. Now, Jamie wouldn't stay. He's like, nope, I'm going to drop you off here so you're safe. And he went back into the fighting. Claire remembers having left Jamie at the stones that day. Her to protect the child and him leaving to basically get rid of it, to fight for his country and fight for his people, but also to make sure he did not survive because he had nothing left that he wanted to live for. He had done everything he could to make sure that if there was no option to have a future with Claire, he was going to protect Claire and the baby and his family, which he did, and his property, which he did, from the English, from the government. And then he was not about to get captured, killed. That's all he wanted, because he did not want to go on if there wasn't a Claire or if there wasn't a family, you know, if it couldn't be what he loved. And so his plan was to go give his life, to lose his life purposely. The rain starts back here in the here and now. Archie remarks that there have been 2 Murchisons, but they're both dead. We find out, or they say, and then Archie leaves. There are some wind gusts, and this reminds Claire of the freezing April rain on Culloden, on the moor. She asks Jamie just how much he remembers, and he says, almost nothing, and that is still too much. Claire reads the letter.
Would you think that was in line with your conversation from the last episode where you were talking about, do you think it's better to not know, or that Roger kept it from her?
It's different, because here, no one's keeping it from Jamie. No one is taking away his agency. To me, it's completely different. But as far as comparing Claire not knowing to his not knowing, I think they both are could be considered a blessing in their own way. I would not necessarily disagree with someone. I could find points of agreement with someone who said Claire's not knowing was a blessing, maybe, because to save her from pain and decision. Jamie's not knowing in his mind probably was like he's happy not to remember, because it was so bad and it was not fun. Like, he lost everyone that day, including Claire. And his child and Myrta, he lost everyone that day. And for him not to remember it, he's like, okay, well, I didn't die. I didn't accomplish what I set out to do. I still lost everyone. But if I have to live with this, then at least I'm not having to live with the memory of it. So I think in that respect, since he did want to die and he didn't end up dying, that I could see maybe. I could understand if Jamie saw it as a blessing that he didn't know more than he did. Or remember more than he did. But as far as how those things happen, I still consider them very different, because one was the result of a natural traumatic occurrence, and the other was a decision to remove someone's agency. I do find them different. But the result, I can see both having, making things a little bit easier for people. What do you think?
I mean, I think in this instance, I think he's seeing it clearly as a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
That he remembers as little as he does.
It's a very human thing not to want to remember trauma.
Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle.
And when we say every kind of lifestyle, we mean every kind of lifestyle. Meal plans include paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, Mediterranean, heart smart, lean and clean, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore.
With that kind of variety, Green Chef makes achieving your 2019 goals easy with dinner options that work around your lifestyle, not the other way around.
Green Chef's expert chefs design flavorful recipes for your lifestyle that go way beyond ordinary substitutions. Enjoy clean ingredients you can trust, ingredients that are seasonally sourced for peak freshness.
Daylight savings time has me dragging you guys, which is why I'm so happy to let Green Chef do the meal planning, grocery shopping, and most of the prep for me. And I got to step out of my comfort zone and cook something I never would have had the guts to cook on my own. Greek shrimp with sweet potato hash, roasted red peppers, and olives. But with the easy to follow recipe cards and my confidence in their quality seafood, it was simple and delicious. Now it's your turn to have everything handpicked and delivered right to your door. Green Chef is offering our listeners $50 off their first box.
For $50 off your first box of Green Chef, go to greenchef.us/ginger. That's greenchef.us/ginger for $50 off your first box of Green Chef. Claire reads the letter. Basically what it's saying, Tryon is now ordering Jamie to call men to arms and to serve as a militia. The time has come. Now, what he says is so sad and so poignant. Our honeymoon with them on the ridge is coming to an end, or at least this one. He says, I had hoped for a little more time, unquote.
They should have known better. I mean, she came through with a timetable.
I know. Michael M. writes, although the last full day of the gathering lasts 17 chapters, oh, thanks, Michael, so we have a little ways to go. This is one of my favorite parts of the series because I can relate to it. I have not attended a gathering, so to speak, but my wife and I, along with our daughters, went on an annual camping canoeing trips with about a dozen other families several years ago, and I can relate. This chapter picks up where Claire is holding surgery and receives Lieutenant Hayes, who seeks her surgical skills. When Claire surmises that the shrapnel did not travel through his body, but traveled along his torso, how many of you thought of the ball that traveled along Jamie's scalp when Galus shot him while he and Claire were in the cave rescuing young Ian? I did not.
It makes me think, did you ever hear Lene's story?
I had a brain image, but I can't tell you what it is, but I want to say yes. I can't tell you what you're going to say, but I'm going to recognize it.
Her dad had this story that he tells, and when he tells it, he dissolves into laughter so deeply that he can barely get the story out trying to retell it. But they were playing, I believe, him and his friends when he was young were playing with a BB gun that they shot one of their friends in the head with a BB gun. And it like hit his skull and like rolled up the scalp. And they had to like cut his scalp to get it back out. And they were all like, I don't know. I don't remember all of it. I wish Lene was here to tell it. But
did they go to the doctor or did the friends cut it out?
No, they did it. Like, to, like, roll it back to, like, the hole to get it out. And then they finally had to, like, cut it open to get the ball
out. He's lucky he did not get an infection. Oh, my gosh.
I'm sure. But, you know, that was back in the time when anti-vaxxers weren't really a thing and everyone was vaccinating their kids. Because they remember smallpox.
That was Summer, not Ginger.
Ah, chapter 8, entitled The Factor, wherein we meet the bugs.
Actually, I wrote the bergs.
The bergs. There's no R in that. They're just bugs.
But it's how the bergs. Der bergs. Der bears. Der bears. Roger is on cloud 9. He's fixated on Bree's words, quote, there'll be a next time, unquote. And then he sets about cleaning himself and getting ready for the wedding. Joe B. writes, Roger is reveling in the shared promise of himself and Bree that they will have another child, one that is theirs. It is an acknowledged promise of a shared future. No one doubts Roger's love for Jemmy, but as he says later, it does matter who his father is. not that he will treat or love him differently to how he would a blood child. I think rather it's that the question of parentage prompting Roger to wish that what he wants to be true actually is true. It's also a reminder of a rather stressful time in his life. Misunderstandings and captivity. There must be a part of him that thinks that if Jemmy is Bonnet's child, it's just insult to injury that his suffering should be rewarded by the certainty that any child of Bree's is his. It's a bit unreasonable and probably mostly unconscious, but it's understandable. He may never know, and he has to live with a question that may not be answered.
Or will it?
Fancy Duncan finds Roger. Accompanied by an...
Okay, so I just have... I don't feel like I've ever asked you this.
Uh-huh. Uh-oh.
This but is a I think it,
PG show, mostly.
Oh, my God, Ginger. Any question about that? I would have asked you to your face privately before I posed it to you. Anything that you're like, this is a family show. This is not about that. My question is, every time I listen to a chapter where they have Duncan Innocent... Innocent in it? I always think to myself... How ironic it is that Duncan LaCroix was cast as Murta, whose character is now standing in for Duncan Innes. So every time they say Duncan, I'm imagining Duncan LaCroix and not Duncan Innes. Is that just a me thing?
Is what a you thing? Imagining Murta instead of Duncan now?
Because every time they say Duncan, I think that they're talking about... I know they're not. But in my brain, I'm like, did they know when they cast Duncan LaCroix as Murta that they were going to be double casting him also as Duncan Innes?
We still don't know that for sure. But he has flounced with her, so...
He's already boffing Jocasta. They're totally making him Duncan Innes.
We don't know that. Because then they would have straight up lied for like 2 years.
Clearly, they straight up lied. I mean, the only difference...
Sorry, stars. Again,
the only difference,
not me. It's my co-host.
The difference is that they're saying, oh, he's not going to be Duncan Innes because they're not changing his name. Because
they're not having a Duncan Innes.
Murta Fitzgibbons. Yeah, that's exactly. But every time I read about Duncan Innes in the book, I can't help but chuckle a little thinking that he's not replacing him, but Murta is played by a dude named Duncan. So I just imagine
that part's funny.
So every time they're like, Duncan, and I'm like, it really is.
So Fancy Duncan finds Roger, accompanied by an older threadbare man. He's kind of rough. They exchange pleasantries, and Duncan introduces him as, the older man, as Mr. Bug, Archbug. And they shake
hands.
Which
fingers is he missing?
We find out later. It's his first two fingers, I think. We find out later why. No, I think it's his thumb and first finger he's missing. But we'll find out later why. Just as he might have spoken himself, Mrs. Bug makes her presence known. And she's a talker, and she's pretty short. And I think plump. I don't think they described her as plump here, but I think she's short. She's tiny.
Short in stature or short in temper?
Yeah. I would say definitely short in stature.
Okay.
She's thankful and is shocked at the state of Roger's coat. She begins, without even asking, she begins to clean it. And then we get to the reason of Duncan's introducing the bugs. Jamie has chosen Mr. Bug as his factor on the ridge. Now, this actually shocks Roger. A factor, quote, for times when himself must be abroad or occupied with other business, unquote. And Mrs. Bug does go on and... As she's going on and he gets like clips of the conversation, he thinks to himself, perhaps Mr. Bug is deaf. I loved it. And then he's like, maybe they just got married like last week. Nope, they've been married for more than 40 years. He's a saint. Roger realized he'd expected Jamie to name him Factor, or at least even if it wasn't conscious, it affected him.
Yeah, it's expected.
It's an expected position.
So I don't disagree with him. And to be choose an elderly man who doesn't have all of his fingers as your predecessor? Is that what you'd call that? Or your replacement? Or the dude that you choose over you? You know, I think he's just like insult to injuring this whole thing, right?
I think he is surprised at maybe the age, but also the lack of, lack of fingers. But He doesn't understand. Because he doesn't know him yet. He doesn't understand his background, how he knows Jamie, his talent, everything like that. He doesn't know Mr. Bug at all. And what he does know is that Mr. Bug is not his son-in-law to be, like, and tonight son-in-law to be. So he is surprised because he never have seen the man, and the fact that it's not him, right? So he realized that he'd expected Jamie to name him Factor. Looking at Mr. Bug's crippled hand, he thinks,
But I wonder if he really expected it at any point in time, or if it was just the acknowledgement of the fact that it wasn't him that was chosen mm-hmm. that made him go.
Yeah, I don't think it was an active thought. Like, he's like, I'm going to be Factor. Because when Fancy Duncan found him, he was not thinking about Factor. He was thinking about getting it on with his wife and making their own baby again. So,
as you do. What else would you do?
He definitely, I think it's less of expectation and more of shock and disappointment because, number one, it wasn't him. And number two, like, who is this dude? Like, I've never even heard of this dude. Like, it's not even someone from the Ridge.
Old fingerless dude.
Old
that fingerless too. Dude that no one has ever met before yeah. is preferable to son-in-law yeah. from the future.
So he's thinking all of this through. He's like, I'm a son-in-law. If any, in families where there's only a daughter and no sons, it's like, the man who marries the daughter is like, he's treated like the next in line for like the next male heir, the male heir. Joe B. writes, his meeting with Duncan again is catalyst for more questions of Roger's place and his acceptance. But before that, he considers himself. He examines the changes in the unassuming Duncan, now transformed into the role he has had thrust upon him. If clothes maketh the man, the respective wardrobes reinforce their positions. Roger wearing a coat of Jamie's and Duncan a new one from Jocasta. Roger is conscious of being again or still reliant on Jamie, whereas Duncan seems more accepting of the clothes of his about to be status as the master of River Run. Any reservations he may have had, no doubt overridden by the generous determination of Jocasta. Duncan could never have thought to marry so well, perhaps at all, let alone become, in effect, the laird of an estate. I wonder, therefore, whether the unexpectedness of marrying Jocasta actually helps him in adjusting to the differences in social status, from subsistence fisherman, prisoner, smuggler, even manager of River Run. Duncan has come from a society where rank and order are accepted. He has probably always relied on someone versus the modern reliance on a system of government, his laird. The governor, Jamie. A beholdenness to Jocasta is just another. And his rise to prominence and property is a reflection of his own virtue and value and skill. A reward, if you like, for his faithfulness. Having grown up in times where he could be the captain of his own ship, the reliance of a tight-knit community, personified in Jamie, is a greater challenge to Roger. This chapter goes some way in giving him a valued place in this time. The Bugs are an example of many things I love. One of the many things I love about Diana's writing. There is comedy in the differences in them, in their physical differences, and they are this series' example of the couple where one, and it is usually the man, talks little and the other talks a lot. A well-matched couple who, through nature or an environment where Mr. Bug has given up trying to get a word in, a bit like my own grandparents, have supported each other for many years. But there's also a deep and abiding love in the Bugs. Rather than have Jamie and Claire, a loving, aspirational couple, although they are, at the center of the wheel of other mismatched, unhappy, and unlikable couples, Diana allows many of the pairs in her world to be as happy and as challenged as Jamie and Claire. Have to ask her why, but to me, it's because that is what it's like in the real world. And love really is all around. I think it's an easy, if not lazy, plot device, and I'm glad it's one not relied upon here. Mr. Bug is another... Mr. Bug is another blow to Roger. The Factor, the operations manager in modern parlance, is a role Roger thought he would have, despite being vastly underqualified for it. His borrowed coat weighs heavily on his shoulders, as he has presented to him the man Jamie believes, quite rightly, will do a better job of managing the ridge when Jamie's away. Now, Mrs. Bug then interrupts his thoughts, Roger's thoughts, and has him take his coat off, and then continues to clean it. And then she combs his hair. Duncan confirms that, yes, he's called the Thrush for his singing and not for his hair. And Mrs. Bug is having a little bit of a, what's that moment you call it? Like, I wrote, she's freaking out a little bit, but she's having like a little, she's a little starstruck. She's like, oh, you were the one who was singing and playing the Boron last night? Oh my gosh.
Just like that. That's exactly how she said it. In fact, if you go back and listen to Davina, that's how Davina said it too.
Joe B writes, thankfully, the indefatigable, what?
What? You want to try that again? Say it again. Do it just like Lord, that again.
No!
Tell me more about your faggotable things, Ginger.
Stop it. I swapped the consonants.
No, you said faggotable. You, please don't ever cut that out. Please leave it. As you're saying, the faggotable, the indefatigable.
Okay, stop saying it. You're making it worse.
Oh my God. It's not worse. It's better. Because every time I say it, I imagine you saying it and how funny it was because you weren't trying to say it. Even though I am physically trying to say it.
Indefatigable.
Faggotable?
No.
I think that's
indefatigable. We won't spell it in a bad way. We'll just flip the T and the G.
I hope not. Good Lord. Faggotable. You're awful.
Careful, you.
It's not an adjective.
Tell me about him. He was faggotable.
Stop it.
Oh.
You're welcome.
Okay, I almost did it again. Fatigable. Fatigable.
Tell me more.
Thankfully, the indefatigable Mrs. Bug comes to the rescue of Roger's abused ego. What now?
Sorry.
You saying it right is almost funnier than you saying it wrong. How is that even possible?
Because I still hear you saying it wrong.
I'm going to pee myself. Stop it.
No, do it.
We're scaring my cat. Ooh.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, baby. Thankfully, the indefatigable Mrs. Bug comes to the rescue of Roger's abused ego in praising his singing at length, and this bombs his soul so he can see the value of the bugs to the ridge and the ridge to the bugs. And he steps up to introduce them to the family. The stroking of Roger's much-abused ego continues as into the scene enters a flustered, frustrated Jamie with a screaming Jemmy, who Roger is able to calm, a welcome reassurance to Roger that Jamie is not actually able to do everything better than he can. Just as Roger invites the bugs to their fire, Jamie appears with a squealing Jemmy and hands him to Roger. Jem was definitely in a state. He asks after Bree and even Marcelly to get someone to feed Jem. Mrs. Bug takes him, changing from a chattering busybody to angel of light, in Roger's estimation. Roger's still stinging from the factor thing, but Mrs. Bug further enters into Roger's good graces. The baby, she's going on about how cute this baby is, and she's like, oh, the baby has the look of his father, and he keeps going. Roger tries to calm himself and reminding himself that this type of talk, especially by women, is normal. And then Mr. Bug includes Roger in the conversation, asking after his Mackenzie relatives. Jamie answers for him. Roger is a Mackenzie of Leach. They learn that some of the Mackenzies of Leach survived. They'd stayed at the castle after the Laird left. Of course, that was Hamish, son of Colum or Dougal. But they wanted to join what was left of their clan. So Hamish and his followers had gone to Acadia, which is Canada. Jem pipes up right about now, and they're like, okay, time to get Bree. Duncan guides Mrs. Bug to their camp, and Jamie stays back with Roger because he has to speak with him. Jamie hands Roger the note from Tryon. Quote, anger hung in the air of the gathering like a bad smell, unquote. After Roger reads it, Jamie tells Roger that he was lucky. He ran into the bugs. He says, when it's time to ride into battle, Claire will ride with us. And he'd expected Roger to ride with him too. Quote, "Come along then, Captain Mackenzie. We've work to be done before you're wed." Unquote. Joe B. writes, "The tide turns for Roger as Jamie acknowledges him as kin in a formal public setting and as a Mackenzie of Leah. And in Jamie's delight that his Mackenzies are in Canada, Arcadia is the former French name for the province that includes what is now Prince Edward Island. Now, is there a chance that Gilbert Blythe could be related to Jamie Fraser?"
No.
In Jamie's sad confession that after Culloden and in prison, he had had no heart to look for them, Roger is reminded of the losses Jamie has had and can share in the joy of the survival of their shared kin. The moment of grace for Roger comes through Tryon's letter to Ray's militia and in yet another example of, why don't you just talk to each other? The reason for why the bugs are coming to the ridge is that Roger won't be there either. Jamie seems genuinely surprised that Roger hasn't figured it out yet. Colonel Fraser needs a junior officer, and Roger Mack, your county wants you. The acceptance Roger has been seeking comes as Jamie calls him Captain Mackenzie and says, we have work to do.
And that was chapter 8, moving right along to chapter 9 entitled Germ of Dissent, which is like equal parts medicinal and not, and historical.
Back with Claire. She's peering at a nasal polyp and thinking of Tryon. Quote, "I felt more charitable toward..."
As
toward,
you do.
"I felt more charitable toward the polyp." Unquote. She's wondering if this was the beginning or one of them. She remembers her history and she knows it's 5 more years until all 13 colonies would be at war. She remembered from Bree's school lessons what the process would be like for Massachusetts, because she lived in Boston, of course. But what was that process like for North Carolina? She did not know. And to all, for all she knew, it could, this could be it beginning now. Quote, "Dissension had been simmering for several years between the planters of the eastern seaboard and the hardscrabble homesteaders of the western backcountry. The regulators were mostly drawn from the latter class. The former were wholeheartedly in Tryon's camp, on the side of the crown." So, we are not going to get present-day political on this show. However, I will say that just thinking about right now in our history, right now what the world, kind of some of the things that are going on in the country, some of the things that are going on in the world, dissension. Now I wrote a word that I can't even read. So of course I pray that nothing like revolution breaks out, but gracious, something feels like it's stirring. And reading about these early days of the revolution is making me have, kind of gave me minor heart palpitations. I think most of that, of course, is through and because of Diana's writing. It's very effective. But I'm not going to lie, I don't always have little fizzles when I read this part. It's exciting as a reader, but that's all I'm going to say. It's just, it's maybe slightly more uncomfortable in this day than in other times I've read it. And so Claire is realizing there's a ton that the history books left out. And then she severed the polyp. So is this narrative, and I swear to you, I read this first before I read on, because I take notes as I go through the chapter. Now, is this narrating of the polyp destruction a metaphor for having to do something, perhaps even painful and bloody, to heal, to effect a healing, to help go forward in a more healthful manner? She narrates the smell of seared flesh and the inspection of the wound. Quote, "The burn would be a vivid red, I knew, but without the light of a scope, it looked black. A small scab hidden like a tick in the hairy shadows of the nostril." Unquote. So a process to promote health and healing, pain and blood is involved. She couldn't see the scab, so she doesn't, just like she doesn't know the events of the revolution and how they occur in North Carolina.
She can see the scab. She can see where it is. She just can't see the color. She very specifically said that, yes. It looked dark.
Yes, but without a light, she couldn't inspect it like she normally would. So she's kind of working in a very dark area. She knew there would be certain things involved. She knew that it would take certain things. And even though she couldn't see it all, she knew they would be there. This reflects, in a way, the process of the war that is to come, especially in North Carolina, because she knows what's happening in a very general sense and a very specific sense with Massachusetts, et cetera. And some of the greater, bigger, maybe more important or high profile events of the war, battles and such. But she doesn't know much of anything about how things progressed in North Carolina. But she knew that this thing was coming. And then she thinks on infection. Quote, that was what was brewing. And
an infection.
Quote, thousands of tiny germs of dissent must linger, forming pockets of conflict throughout the colonies. The regulation was only one. Unquote. She likens the note from Tryon as a small flame, one that would burn and sear its way through homes and families. Quote, the end of it would be a clean excision, but a great deal of blood would flow before the hot irons of guns should sear the open wound. Unquote. And then she asks the silliest question she has ever uttered.
I'm ready.
Were we never to have a little peace, Jamie and I?
Bitch.
Exactly. I didn't have that answer.
You have owned a history book or had access to history books
for 20 years.
For literally ever. And for you to question whether or not you would have peace with him in this time period, in this place, you're not getting far enough away.
You called Claire a bitch. That's hysterical.
I would not be the first.
Oh, I don't doubt it, but it just startled me. That was funny. Because my reaction, yours was, bitch, blah, blah, blah. Mine was, ha, 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 ha. Yeah, no. Leanne F. writes, Claire provides a history lesson that we probably all need, especially the first time we encounter the North Carolina political situation in 1770. She gives the slaves some medicinal whiskey, which is always helpful, while thinking, ironically, that the seeds of revolution might be, quote, being sown directly under my own nose, unquote, since she, too, knows more about the pre-revolutionary history of Massachusetts rather than what was going on further south in North Carolina. She has little more foresight of what is to come their way than the average citizen at this point. As she muses while she works, Claire whistles while you work. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Muse while you work. That was funny. Claire connects the possible infection the slave might experience with the political turmoil in the air. The tiny germs of dissent will come to infect all the colonies in just a few short years. I like this metaphor since it explores the unseen way political movements gain momentum and become large enough for an epidemic that catches the imagination of the population.
But does she really like that? Because it's literally the title of the chapter, Germs of Dissent.
I don't know.
We know that Diana comes up with her titles for her chapters based upon the content of the chapters. We all know this. However, when it is titular in nature, it sticks out. So when you know that it's a chapter called Germs of Dissent, and then midway through the chapter, she's like, it's like the germs of dissent. And you're like, oh, okay. I don't know. Every time that the title of the chapter is literally a sentence within the chapter, I kind of go, "Wee!" Like my ears perk up.
Leanne F. continues. Claire goes one metaphor further as she imagines the flame she uses to sterilize the cauterizing iron corresponding with Tryon's letter in Jamie's sporran, which she equates to a flame as well. Finally, Claire asks the question all readers of the series wonder about from time to time. Were we never to have a little peace, Jamie and I? Hell
nope.
No, Claire. Have you not been paying a pen? Oh my God. Paying
what, try that again?
Have you not been
paying a pension?
Have you not been paying attention in the previous four books? Gracious.
I don't know, Ginger. Have you been tang a pension in the last, like, few chapters?
Tonight's all about the spoonerisms. I am flipping consonants here and there. Next.
None of those will fit on a license plate, so I need you to stop right now.
What? You want to get a new license plate?
No, I'm just saying. Oh, because you're never going to, like,
I'm not trying.
Eclipse Grange.
I'm not trying. Next scene. Roger is with Jamie, chatting up men to invite/muster to the militia, giving him advice on whom to approach, the number of kids different people have, and how to approach them. And after he talks to everyone, he's like, look, get these people. We will all muster at Fraser's Ridge in a fortnight. The weather, it's mizzling.
What was that?
Mizzling.
What does that mean?
It is not quite.
Is that like drizzling kind someplace
of.
Between
it's a drizzle misty drizzle, and a- kind of, yeah. Jamie tells Roger to go see the person, this one person, all Joan, and they'll have something to eat before the wedding. So actually, Jamie's told him, okay, go see these like four or five people, ask these questions, tell them we're going to meet at Fraser's Ridge in a fortnight. So he has a job to do. Jamie tells Roger to lead with himself as Captain Mackenzie, and they'll mind him better. So far, the people that Jamie had approached had agreed to join. And Roger's thinking, instant soldier, just add water. The historian in Roger is gagging for this. He admits to himself some excitement and thinks of the coming war. He feels it in his belly. War is really coming. Now, he goes off and does talk to the people he told Jamie he would speak to. And just as he'd finished with Angus Ogg, the mizzle stops. So there has to be something important there, but I don't know. All Joan was not old at all. She was in her, she's a pretty woman in her mid-30s. She was thoughtful.
Pretty woman.
And shares that an aunt of hers has a room in the king's house. And she, her aunt, had witnessed the mobs there in Hillsborough. So remember, Roger has been tasked to go get as many people to promise to come muster on Fraser's Ridge to form a militia to go meet Tryon, as ordered. So it's in Roger's best interest to, you know, be authoritative, but be respectful and be as nice as you can while going around asking for people. But he has everything to lose. These people don't. I mean, in the war, everyone has everything to lose. But as far as right now, we're not there yet. Right now, it's just, will you come be part of this militia? So one of the people he was supposed to go speak with was old Joan, because she had two sons. And so here he is asking Joan about her menfolk to send them to be part of a militia to go fight for Tryon. And so her first response is, you know, I have an aunt who lives in Hillsborough. She witnessed the mobs firsthand. They were a clock of demons. They destroyed Fanning's house. Fanning was the main man who was targeted. It was across the street from where her aunt lives. And she asks a very fair question. She's like, we're now asked to send our men to pull Fanning's chestnuts from the fire, are we? So she finds it kind of rich, and I totally understand where she's coming from, that she is now being asked. So she is feeling it's rather rich that she's being asked to basically donate the use of her sons and then possibly lose their lives. Donate her sons to go possibly fight for Tryon, who, if not personally, was related to kind of the cause or side cause that caused the rioters to riot in the first place. Like that's where the two sides are. So and I get it. It's very ironic. And she's like, that's rich. So she does tell him about her aunt. So she's not buying this governor nonsense. She has Roger follow her to where she meets her brother. Now her brother, I don't know the proper terminology. He's definitely significantly disabled or...
Well, they said spastic, and I thought you would have definitely looked that up, but clearly you didn't.
I did not. I didn't think spastic was a word that would be used now.
Cerebral palsy.
Oh, okay.
Scholarly articles for spastic cerebral palsy.
Spastic refers to an alteration in muscle tone affected by the medical condition spasticity, which is seen in spastic diplegia and many other forms of cerebral palsy. Okay. So it sounds like her brother had a form of cerebral palsy, and he couldn't. He obviously could speak to a certain amount that she could understand him, but he was the man of the house.
It struck me that he was not always like this, that it was a degenerative condition, that at some point he had been able to speak and converse, and they between them now had sort of a shorthand. That's kind of what I took from it.
So she takes him to her brother, who is there on a pallet, basically, and his body twisted, and Roger is very much affected. And he mentions the militia muster, and through his sister, Ian, asks if there will be bounty money paid. Roger says he doesn't know. Maybe there will be, but at this point, nothing's been promised. Nothing is finalized. Now, Roger helps in the only kindness he could really do for the man. He helps cover him up, like pulls his shirt back up to cover his shoulder, pulls a blanket up, and notices that more of their family had arrived. Joan says her sons are Hugh and Ian Ogg. She's like, I only have one question for you. If I lend you my sons, will you promise me then to send them safe home? Well, what a question. Like, that's, it's not even like, it's not even a, could you send your men to help join this militia? Yes or no. She's not even saying, I mean, she is saying yes, obviously, but she's not saying, okay, yes. She's like, what will you promise me? Right. It's like, no pressure there, Roger. And so she agrees to send them. And scene. And just before we close out, we are still on the same day.
Good Lord. Get used to it, guys.
Leanne F. writes, I really enjoy Roger's joking with himself about becoming an instant soldier, and all he needs to do is just add water. His pride at Jamie's trust in him, though, is very endearing here. The more seriously Roger imagines how all soldiers have to learn about being a soldier the hard way, they go from playing a soldier to being one, a trial by doing the thing itself as you go. And Roger's interaction with the Findlay family brings the danger and reality of being a soldier to vivid life, as it allows us to focus in on one family and the potential impact to the grindingly poor Findlays if the two sons given into Roger's keeping did not come home again. The commitment of Jamie, Roger, and the men they are recruiting is made real as we see Roger giving his word to all Joanie that he will do all that he can to ensure the boys come home again.
And that was Chapter 9. Join us next time when we will be discussing Chapter 10, Granny Bacon's Gifts, and Chapter 11, entitled Pride. And as always, if you'd like to join us and be a contributor to our read-along, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/fierycross. There you'll find a spreadsheet link that you can go into and see the available chapters that we have and the openings. And if you just message us and let me know which chapters you want, I will add you to the mix.
And as ever, to help us continue the conversation, please join us in our Facebook community. You can do that at outlanderpod.com/group. Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.